This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is George Monbiot, a weekly columnist for The Guardian and also the best-selling author of The Age of Consent and Captive State, as well as the investigative travel books Poisoned Arrows, Amazon Watershed, and No Man's Land. His website, www.monbiot.com, is listed by Yahoo as the most popular columnist site on Earth outside of the United States. In 1995, Nelson Mandela presented George Monbiot with the United Nations Global 500 Award for Outstanding Environmental Achievement. George Monbiot is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Heat: How to Stop the Planet from Burning. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Diane.
What prompted you to write Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning?
Well, I was giving a lecture in London, and at the end of it, someone stood up and said, you have called for an 80% cut in the emissions of carbon dioxide from countries like the United Kingdom. When that is done, what will this country look like? And I hadn't the faintest idea what the answer was. And so I saw a climate change campaigner I knew in the audience, someone I got great respect for, Mayor Hillman, and I said, well, that's such an easy question that Mayor Hillman here can answer it. And he stood up and said, a very poor third world country. And I thought, well, I have to try to demonstrate that this cut can be made without reducing rich nations to very poor third world countries. In fact, I have to show that we can make the necessary cut to prevent runaway climate change while retaining our comforts and the standard of living which we are accustomed to. That's what I set out to do in Heat, and I think and I hope I have succeeded.
Could you speak about the issue of equity in climate change?
Yes, this is a critical issue because above everything else, climate change is a moral concern. And the reason for this is that the people who are going to be hit hardest and hit first, in fact, many of them are being hit already by climate change, are the people who are least responsible for the problem. If you take Ethiopia, for example, in Ethiopia, people produce less than 1/1000th of the carbon emissions per person that are produced per person in the United States. And yet, climate change is already affecting them in devastating ways. Because of rising sea surface temperatures in the Indian Ocean, these short rains, the belg rains in Ethiopia, are now failing year after year. And that's having a profound impact on people's ability to support themselves and to survive as the amount of food they produce is reduced. We have a situation in which, because the rich nations, by and large, are in the temperate parts of the world, through all sorts of historical and geographical accidents, they are going to be the last nations and the least to be hit by climate change. And yet they are the ones who are most responsible for it. So my appeal to people is an appeal to their wider humanity to recognize that the actions that we take at home, which seem so innocent, turning on the lights, driving the kids to school, they even seem good sometimes, flying to the other side of the planet to go to our sister's wedding, those actions are having mortal consequences for other people who are not responsible for this problem.
In terms of reducing emissions, could you comment on the degree to which people in different countries need to reduce their emissions if everybody is to share equally in this process?
Right. Well, what I've done is to look at, first of all, the relationship between the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and global temperature. Then the ability of the world's natural systems, the biosphere, to absorb carbon dioxide, and then rising world population. And when you put all those things together, you realize that if we are to prevent runaway climate change, which really means stopping global temperatures rising by more than about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit above their pre-industrial level, we require a global cut of 60% in the greenhouse gases that we're producing between now and 2030. if that global cut is to be distributed equally, which according to any principles of justice it should be, that means that the countries which are currently producing the most carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases have to make the biggest cut in order to get down to the equal level, which would mean that everybody on Earth has the same right to produce carbon dioxide. What that means is that the rich nations like the United States and the United Kingdom require roughly a 90% cut in greenhouse gas emissions between now and 2030 if we are to stop runaway climate change.
In your view, how strong is the political will right now to make the cuts that will be needed?
Well, there is political will to make cuts, but not currently to make cuts of the magnitude that are needed. And even governments which have been quite progressive on this issue, such as the government of the United Kingdom, are deceiving themselves about the size of the cuts which need to be made. And in fact, the UK is sticking with an old target using science which is long outdated of cutting carbon dioxide emissions by 60% by 2050. It sounds like an ambitious target, but it's based on a paper which was produced 7 years ago, and since then a whole raft of scientific papers have shown that to have a high chance of preventing runaway climate change, you need a much stiffer cut than that. And so even the governments which are really taking climate change quite seriously are not taking it seriously enough. When you come to the governments of North America, the United States and Canada, you find that they've got no serious programs at all for cutting greenhouse gases. In fact, both Bush and Harper talk only of reducing the carbon intensity of the economy. And what that means is that you reduce the amount of carbon dioxide made for every unit of production in the economy. Well, number one, that means that you are not actually making an overall cut in the amount of carbon dioxide that your country produces. But secondly, you're just saying we're going to stick with business as usual, because as every economy matures, the amount of energy it uses per unit of productivity declines anyway.
What do you see as the underlying cause of people not addressing and or not wanting to address climate change?
I think it's that we really want to believe that we can carry on without having to make any serious changes to our lives. And people feel extremely threatened when you confront them with the consequences of climate change and with the knowledge of what that means they have to do if they're not to be part of the problem, this terrible problem which is affecting many millions of people. And people quickly go into denial, just as they might go into denial if the doctor tells them that they've got a serious disease, or if the bank tells them that their debts have become unsupportable. It's the news we don't want to hear. And much as I dislike this task, it seems that my role in life is to tell people things they don't want to hear. And it doesn't always make me very popular.
Would you now speak about your idea for rationing as a way to cut our emissions?
Yes, I think that the only fair way in which we can deal with this problem is to say that everyone should have an equal entitlement to produce carbon dioxide, because that means that you start from a position of social justice. You start from a position which says no one is going to be privileged above anyone else as far as their impact on the planet is concerned. And the way you do that is to say, let's take the sustainable level of carbon dioxide emissions in 2030, which the whole world must work down towards, and let's divide that up between all the people of the world so that you can see what their equal entitlement should be. You then say, for every nation, people would have roughly 40% of that entitlement to use themselves. And the reason for that is that 40% is the amount of energy that we consume directly when we pay our electricity bills, our heating bills, and when we put fuel in the tanks of our cars. That's the energy we consume directly, as opposed to the energy that's consumed on our behalf. And that becomes our carbon ration, that 40% of the sustainable quota. You would have a credit card, for example, or a debit card, which contains that ration. And every time you paid for your electricity, or you paid for your heating bill, or you paid for your gasoline, you would hand over a part of that ration, just as you also hand over some cash in dollars. You've got a parallel currency system, if you like. And that means that you are constantly thinking about how you can make sure you don't exceed your carbon ration. If you do exceed it, and you want to carry on using fossil fuels, then you must buy extra ration from someone who's used less than their share. Now, if everybody is trying to do that, the cost of the extra ration could become quite expensive. And so you have a very powerful built-in incentive here for people to say, right, well, I want to keep the lights on, but I don't want to use up all my carbon ration, so I'm going to switch to low-energy light bulbs, and I'm going to buy electricity from a supplier who's producing it with wind turbines. And by means such as that, you can start to develop a complete system for dealing with the problem of climate change.
So individuals would have 40%. How about the other 60%?
Yes, the other 60% should be auctioned off to the corporations and the government departments which use it on our behalf. Now, at the moment in Europe, we have a system a little bit similar to this called the European Emissions Trading Scheme. And in principle, it does something similar to that. But unfortunately, it started off on the wrong foot because it gave away the carbon entitlements to the big corporations, and it gave them to the corporations on the basis of how much pollution they were creating already. It was completely the wrong way to do it. It meant that, number one, the polluter got paid, which is the opposite to the principle of the polluter pays. And number two, it meant that something that belongs to all of us, the entitlement to produce carbon dioxide, was given preferentially to these corporations.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with columnist and author George Monbiot about his book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. Based on the research that you've done, what do you consider the best sources of electricity if we want to cut our carbon dioxide emissions?
Well, we can't rely on a single source. And the reason for this is that while I would love to see a switch entirely to renewable sources of electricity, in order to maintain a stable electricity supply on the electricity grids, you need to have some secure and reliable forms of electricity as well. For example, the demand for electricity through the day fluctuates wildly. In the south of the United States, for instance, it'll be strongest at midday because that's when people turn their air conditioners up because it gets hottest. In the north, it's likely to be strongest in the evening, especially on winter evenings when people come back home from work and they turn on the lights and they turn on the television and they turn on the power shower, and you'll see a great peak in demand there. Now, unfortunately, the wind does not blow and the sun does not shine on demand. You can't switch them on as the demand for electricity is switched on. Now, of course, with other kinds of power, you can switch them on. You can switch on an ordinary thermal power station to match that demand. So that there has to be a mixture. And I suggest that with some clever energy storage technologies and a great diversification of supply, you could produce about 50% of all your electricity from renewable sources. In other words, wind, waves, tidal power, and solar power. But beyond 50%, you are really straining at the technological limits of how much variable supply the grid can take. So then you have to look at other means of producing electricity more reliably. And I'm afraid it comes down to a pretty ugly choice. You either have to choose nuclear power, or you have to choose thermal power, natural gas or coal, with carbon capture and storage. And that means stripping the carbon dioxide out of the waste stream, piping it away, and burying it in a deep geological formation. Now, I don't like either option, but we have to choose one of them if we're not to be subject to perpetual power cuts. And if we're to make these ideas politically viable, we have to ensure that we aren't subject to perpetual power cuts.
So which of those choices would you vote for?
Okay, well, I'd actually divide them into three choices, which is natural gas with carbon capture and storage, coal with carbon capture and storage, and nuclear power. And I think number one would be natural gas with carbon capture and storage. Number two, my second choice would be nuclear power. And my third choice would be coal with carbon capture and storage. And the reason I put coal at the bottom is because of the devastating impacts of open cast coal mining. For instance, if you look at the mountaintop removal taking place in the Appalachian Mountains, it would be hard put for anyone to look at that and not see that it's a complete environmental disaster. Now, the big problem that you have in North America that we do not have in Europe is that your supplies of natural gas have already peaked and are going into decline. In Europe, if you look at Eurasia as a whole, our supplies are still rising. And natural gas is hard to transport over very long distances and across the sea in energetically efficient ways. And so I think we have to conclude that that North America is no longer going to be able to rely on natural gas as a means of keeping the lights on. I'm afraid, much as I dislike this conclusion, that part of the energy supply will have to come from nuclear power.
Would you comment also on our continued use of the current electrical grid compared to more localized generation of electricity in terms of potential impact on climate change?
Yes, thank you for raising this. It's a very important issue. Many environmentalists want us to switch to an entirely localized supply, often called the energy internet or microgeneration. And there are a few problems with this. One is that if you're relying largely on renewable sources of power, your power supplies are going to be much more variable than if you are using a national scale grid. And the reason for this is that while the wind might stop blowing in Seattle, it could still be blowing in Boston. But if you're getting all your wind power from Seattle, it means that if the wind stops blowing, there's no wind. There's no wind anywhere for you to use if you're only using a local electricity grid. So the wider we draw our sources of power from, the more reliable renewable electricity becomes. And I now advocate, far from going local as far as the grid is concerned, going as wide as possible and sending out massive grid extensions way out to sea, for example, with undersea cables, preferably carrying direct rather than alternating current, connected to vast offshore wind turbines. I would like to see huge solar arrays of the kind which we're beginning to see built in Southern California used much more extensively and plugged into the national grid. I think we need to draw our sources of renewable energy from as wide an area as possible. And that directly contradicts the ideal that many people have of denationalizing the grid and going local.
To what extent can improved energy efficiency help attain the needed cuts in greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, it's certainly an essential, a critical part of the mix, but there is a limit to how useful it is, unfortunately. There's a point beyond which we aren't going to get very far with it. My own calculations, drawing on work conducted here in Oxford University, suggest that as far as household energy use is concerned, about the maximum cut that we can get through energy efficiency between now and 2030 will be about 40%. And this is partly because people aren't going to get rid of their televisions. They might go to more energy efficient kinds. They're not going to get rid of their computers. In fact, we see the volume of electronic gadgets rising. And also because with houses which have already been built, there's a limit to how much energy efficiency you can retrofit them with. When you're building a new house, you can make it extremely efficient. When you're building an old house, you can definitely make it more efficient, but you can't make it nearly as efficient as a house built from scratch can be. And when you put all that together and when you look at the replacement rate of buildings, you see that 40% is really straining at the limits. The rest of the carbon cut has to come from replacing the sources of electricity and heat that we now use.
What is the best way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector, based on your research?
Well, I think there are several ways, and one of the ones that I'm very excited about is to transform the intercity bus service into a much faster, more effective and more efficient system which people would actually want to use in preference to the car. And the reason that I focus on this is that it's the most carbon efficient form of transport. You use about 10% of the emissions per passenger mile when you're on an intercity bus that you do when you're traveling in a car. And in principle, if the system were quite significantly changed, it could be a very efficient means of transport and a much more pleasant form of transport than Greyhound buses are today, one that richer people might want to use, for example. And the proposal I favour is this, that you close down the bus stations in the city centres and you move them out to the junctions of the highways, of the big interstate roads. You then extend your urban public transport systems out to meet them. And that not only means that you are not dragging the buses into the city centre and subjecting them to all the traffic jams, which makes their progress so slow, but it also means that you are revitalizing your urban public transport networks by ensuring that they can serve the suburbs more effectively on their way to the big highways. Once you reach the highway, you go into the bus station, which is at the junction of the highway, and you find buses coming through every 2 or 3 minutes. You can organize it much more effectively if the buses stick to the highways and don't go into the cities, because they can be timetabled much more precisely. You then ensure that the buses stick on dedicated lanes all the way along the highway. In other words, by having their own lane, again, they do not get held up by other traffic, and this makes them faster than the car. And what you then have is an interchange system whereby people can change quickly from one bus to another at the junctions of the highways so they can get onto another highway. Overall, you can ensure that your bus journey times are shorter than your journey times for the car. And you can also do all those things that you want to do when you're driving a car but you aren't allowed to. You can go to sleep, you can watch a movie, you can talk on the telephone, you can conduct business, you can eat a meal. If these buses were better designed to be a luxury form of transport, they could be seen to save a great deal of people's time and to ensure that much of the time that people waste commuting nowadays could be spent either in doing work or in sleeping or leisure.
Air travel is the one sector for which you reported you were unable to find a good solution for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. First, to what extent does air travel contribute to greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, it's a good question because it depends on which greenhouse gases you count. If you look at carbon dioxide alone, it's currently about 3% of total global emissions. But carbon dioxide is just one of the greenhouse gases that air travel produces. And in order to look at the total impact, you have to multiply that 3% by about 2.5 times. But as far as the individual is concerned, air travel can have by far the biggest impact of anything else we do. In one day, you can produce as much carbon dioxide as you do in the whole of the rest of the year by taking a long-haul international flight. There are two reasons for this. One of them is, as I've suggested, that air travel produces other greenhouse gases. The other one is the sheer distance over which you travel. As far as carbon dioxide is concerned, the amount produced per passenger mile is very similar to the amount you produce in a car. But while you might travel 10,000 miles in a car in a year, you can travel 10,000 miles in a plane in one day.
What potentially can be done to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from air travel?
Unfortunately, there is no techno fix. I've looked into every possibility, and they either don't improve by any significant amount the greenhouse gas emissions from aeroplanes, or they can actually make the situation worse. For instance, hydrogen planes are far more damaging than planes fueled by kerosene. And so the only option here, unfortunately, is to say we have to reduce the number of flights we take.
And so the implications for people that do a lot of travel are going to be significant.
They are. And what I strongly advocate is that we replace as many of our unnecessary journeys as we can with video conferencing. It's a technology I've been using recently myself, and it's wonderful. When it's properly set up, it really is just like being there. And you can have business meetings, you can conduct lectures, you can do many of the things for which people fly while still seated at your desk. I spoke to 1,600 people in Toronto last week by video conference call, and it was just like being there. People came up to the camera and asked me questions, and I answered those questions, and I could engage with people, I could interact with them. I didn't miss anything from not being there. In fact, it was rather good because I didn't get pestered by anyone afterwards. And I don't see any reason why, in a situation like that, I would have needed to fly, given that we now have this very good video conferencing technology. Secondly, I think we've got to greatly reassess our holidays and look to the virtues of places much closer to home than those that we've been traveling to. The big question is what I call love miles, which is the distance between yourself and the people that you love, which can sometimes only be bridged by air travel. And that's in a way the most intractable cause of climate change, a great profound irony here that the planet can be destroyed by love. And that's a situation where it's very difficult to say to people you can't travel. So I think what I say to people instead is travel less frequently and for longer when you go to see your loved ones.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would like to say this, that climate change is the most important moral issue of the 21st century. If you care about hunger, if you care about poverty, if you care about the planet, if you care about any of the good things of life, you must also care about climate change because it affects all the other things that we are concerned by. And to care about climate change is not enough. You have to act on it. And that means, above all, becoming political. We can act as consumers. There are various things we can do to cut our own energy use. But that's going to have no traction. It's going to have no wider effect unless we also act as citizens, unless we also lobby our governments at the federal level, the state level, the municipal level, to make it easier for people to do the right thing and harder for them to do the wrong thing. Otherwise, we just create ecological space for other people to occupy. You can get rid of your car, but all you do is to create new space on the road for someone to drive a less efficient model than you would have driven. Unless, in getting rid of your car, you also lobby the government to ensure that the extra road space is then taken away from cars and given over to buses or bicycles or pedestrians, your decision's not going to have any effect. So don't just be a better consumer. Be a better citizen.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. That's my pleasure, Diane.
We have just been speaking with columnist and author George Monbiot about his book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning, published in 2007 by South End Press. For more information about the book, check on the web at www.southendpress.org. Again, that's southendpress.org. And George Monbiot's website is www.monbiot.com. Again, www.monbiot.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.